You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Maria McKinley.
And I'm Ryan Stacy. This is the Daily Local News for Thursday, December 8th, 2016.
So here in Bloomington, almost every cool old building has been repurposed in some way.
Michael Glab speaks with restoration architect Cynthia Brubaker on today's episode of Big Talk. That's coming up later in the show.
Also coming up the next half hour, our weekly public opinion feature, Voices in the Street, asks where Bloomington gets its news. But first, these local headlines.
A Canadian company is taking the first steps toward developing a citywide high-speed fiber network in Bloomington. Mayor John Hambleton made the announcement this morning, following up on one of the biggest promises he made during the 2015 mayoral campaign. Hambleton has described high-speed digital connectivity as the 21st century equivalent to electricity. The company, Axia, signed a letter of intent with the city to develop the project. In a press conference, Hambleton described the way he hoped the network would work.
It should be citywide. We shouldn't leave any neighborhoods behind this 21st century infrastructure. Everyone needs to have the opportunity to be connected. Second, it should be an open network, either community controlled to assure open access to many providers, or otherwise configured to assure increased access, competition, and innovation. And third, it should be financially feasible, both in construction and operation. It shouldn't burden our local fiscal condition.
Hambleton did not discuss how much the city expects to pay for development of the project. Before Axia takes further steps toward building a network, Hambleton says the company plans to study various aspects of Bloomington.
So over the next 2 to 3 months, Axia will be doing detailed construction, design, and pricing to determine for certain the financial viability of the model in our community. Then there will be a similar expression of interest period during which all members of our community will have the chance to indicate whether or not we agree and want this model to come to town.
Axia has developed networks in Alberta, Canada, as well as Singapore, France, and elsewhere. The CEO of the company, Art Price, says their business model is based on treating fiber systems like infrastructure rather than proprietary networks. That means that companies like Smithville and Comcast would still be able to use the network. Price warns the project won't be simple to develop.
This would be the first community of this character in the United States that's actually done this business model. It's not easy. If it was easy, we'd have already done it, right? Everybody already have it. But we have been successful everywhere. We've actually implemented this business model because at the core of it, the end user gets to choose what service they choose from third parties, and they all have to compete.
Today's announcement comes just more than 3 months after Smithville Fiber announced it would make high-speed fiber access available to about 1,600 Bloomington homes. Hambleton was critical of Smithville's plan at the time, saying that a, quote, cherry-picking approach would tend to serve wealthier households while leaving behind lower-income areas of the city. Smithville is an underwriter at WFHB.
In last night's City Council meeting, council members gave their final approval to a fee schedule for the rental of city facilities, including City Hall. The city already has a policy in place to allow nonprofit groups to use city meeting spaces. The policy has recently been changed to allow for-profit groups to use city meeting spaces for a fee. In their November 30th work session, Councilmember Steve Volan, Allison Chopra, and Isabel Piedmont-Smith expressed concern about the use of city facilities by groups whose philosophy or mission conflicts with the city's human rights ordinance. Volan asked the city's corporate counsel, Philippa Guthrie, whether the city might have any recourse in such a situation.
If it's a private for-profit entity or a
not-for-profit, public group. It doesn't matter. We can't regulate viewpoint.
In last night's meeting, Piedmont Smith said she still had concerns but would approve the fee schedule.
Overall, we shouldn't restrict speech, and we hope that this is a community where the groups that espouse hate would not be using our space.
Last week's work session, Guthrie told the council the city was not looking to make a profit from the fees, only to reimburse itself for expenses. Council member Allison Chopra, who cast the lone no vote, said she thought the city shouldn't be in the business of renting space to for-profit groups, even if it's not making a profit.
To me, this just feels like the city's undercutting the business community. And for a stronger economy, I'd rather see a business need met by a business who can bring in jobs and tax dollars and all the rest of it.
The rental policy stipulates the city and its departments have priority over rooms previously reserved by community groups and can bump the group at the last minute. Guthrie said ultimately conducting the city's business will take priority, and groups are given notice of that priority in advance. Council member Susan Sandberg said she didn't think the city will see much interest from private for-profit groups.
If I were a professional event planner, I would not want to spend a lot of money on an event that I have to cater and decorate and bring in all kinds of people, knowing that maybe within a week I'll have to find another venue because City Hall takes priority over city business. So I don't anticipate we're going to see quite as much of that private for-profit usage as we think. I could be wrong, and if it does become a burden and it does cause us issues for us to be able to carry out the city's business here, then I think we'll all be taking a second look at it.
The council also gave its final approver to $525,000 in year-end appropriations. Projects funded include additional police training and various road projects. Controller Jeff Underwood said money for the road projects comes from the Local Option Income Tax Fund, or LOIT Fund.
The balance in the fund is $2.23 million, and that was the special distribution. We have to come to you all to appropriate funds out of that, and it is to be used primarily for the construction and rehabilitation of road projects. So it's got a very narrow focus. We can buy equipment that would repair the road. So if we bought a paver or dump trucks are primarily, we're going to be used to haul asphalt or a striping machine or something like that. But it specifically excludes trail.
Underwood said more than $40,000 of the appropriations came from a rebate check the city received from Duke Energy. That money is paying for the installation of LED lighting in the showers building.
In their meeting this week, the Bloomington Plan Commission heard a petition from the Horvath Communications to put a cell tower at 1901 South Weimer Road between Tap Road and Sudbury Drive. The petition requests a use variance to install a 194-foot cell phone pole in an area zoned residential. Will Gooden, attorney for Horvath Communications and Verizon Wireless, said growth in the area indicated a need for increased capacity to access digital and wireless data on portable devices. Gooden said the site is buffered by woods on the east and south side of the site, and the tower will be set 200 feet away from adjacent property lines.
This is a total tower height of 199 feet, does not require lighting by the FAA, and is 195 feet actual with a 4-foot lightning rod. At this particular location, based upon the need for this new tower, Verizon would occupy, as is indicated with the darker shading, the top location on this tower, with the three other co-locations available directly below that.
Senior zoning planner Jackie Scanlon said the growth policies plan does not designate specific locations for community facilities.
When the GPP was written in 2002, I mean, cell phone service life was not as much a part of our lives as it is today. So it just did not specifically call out a plan for where those could be located. And actually creating such a plan would be very difficult because of all of the things that go into making those site selections anyway. So no specific locations or guidelines were given in the GPP for the location of infrastructure for that type of service.
Scanlon said a staff review concludes it does not interfere with the intent of the GPP. The commission approved giving the variance request a positive recommendation to the Board of Zoning Appeals.
Stone Belt ARC plans a holiday art fair this Saturday, December 10th, from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., featuring gifts created by clients. Silk scarves, decorative boxes, pillows, and artwork will be available at the fair to be held at 2815 East 10th Street here in Bloomington. The show supports the agency's efforts to empower and support Hoosiers with developmental disabilities by giving them dignity, self-worth, and the right to self-determination. More information can be found at stonebelt.org. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Maria McKinley.
And I'm Ryan Stacy. Support for WFHB and the Daily Local News comes from Smithville Fiber, a local provider of internet, voice, and TV service, now also offering home automation and security systems for homes and offices throughout South Central Indiana. More information on Smithville's home automation service is available at smithvillesecurity.com.
Restoration architect Cynthia Brubaker helps Bloomington retain its past. She has been responsible for the rebirth of such historic structures as the I. Fell Building and the old Coca-Cola bottling plant that now serves as the multipurpose headquarters for Middleway House. Brubaker knew early on she wanted to be involved in resurrecting nearly forgotten architectural treasures. She joins Michael Glab on this week's edition of Big Talk.
Hi. This is Big Talk. Michael Glab here with my in-studio guest, Cynthia Brubaker. Cindy, thanks for coming on the show.
It's my pleasure, Mike. I'm happy to be here.
Cindy, what does a restoration architect do?
I do a lot of different things.
Uh-huh.
I work with architects and I do some design work. I do drawing and drafting. I go look at buildings to evaluate them and see what they need to have fixed about them. Do they have crumbling brick and stone and deteriorating wood and that sort of thing? We work with clients who want to restore their historic building, rehabilitate their historic building.
Now, many of us want to see historic structures, parts of our past, preserved. Well, who wouldn't?
Well, let me just give you an example of who wouldn't. So several years back in our history, folks wanted to tear down the Monroe County Courthouse. Luckily, that didn't happen. And instead, we have a direction where all sorts of buildings are now being considered worthy of keeping and reusing and repurposing. For example, lots of industrial buildings that are here on the west side of Bloomington are now, it's almost now trendy to want to be have a business or an art studio or what have you in an industrial building. And 20 years ago, this was not considered a worthy effort.
Where did you come from?
I was born in Indiana. However, I grew up in the East, Maryland, Pennsylvania, came back to Indiana for college.
Okay.
Goshen College in northern Indiana.
As an undergrad, what did you study?
Art. I was interested in architecture, but they did not have that major at my school. I thought I would study that in graduate school. Went to New York, went for a job at Columbia University, where they had an architectural history graduate program, and I picked up their catalog. And page after page after page of architectural history classes, I thought I'd found heaven.
Wow.
And I thought, okay, I'll just take these classes forever and maybe I'll teach architecture students architectural history. And remember, this is quite a while ago, Mike. So this is back when the term historic preservation was not in common parlance at all. And I was walking down a hallway one day at Columbia and saw a poster that was a line drawing of the Helen Hayes Theater in New York, which had been demolished, and it was an advertisement for Columbia's graduate program in historic preservation. And I looked at that poster and I said, that's for me.
Do you remember your first restoration project?
One of the first things I did was on the north side of the Courthouse Square, where now there is Pictora Gallery.
Yes.
At the time, historically, older folks from town may remember it as Alden's Department Store.
Mm-hmm.
And the folks who owned the building were interested in doing something with it, came to Portfolio Design, which is the architectural firm I worked in at the time, with John Schell. And we talked to them about their options, and I suggested that we do it as a historic rehab. They could get some tax incentives in exchange for that. And I kind of convinced everybody to move ahead with that.
What's the name of your business?
I work as a private independent contractor. And for the last little over a year or so, I've been working with an architectural firm called Spring Point Architects, and most of the work that I do is with them. The other big project that I have that is primarily me is the Eiffel Building. And that business is Eiffel LLC. I'm the proprietor of that and preservation developer of that project.
Do you mean to say that you own that building?
I wish I did, Mike. But I always say, if I can't own it, at least I can say that it is still owned by the Fell family.
There's another building of historic nature that I understand you might have had a hand in, and a Coca-Cola bottling company? Is that right?
That is correct. The Coca-Cola bottling company plant is on South Washington Street. And that project happened when I was working with Middleway House on a grant to evaluate a housing co-op, which was an idea that the executive director, Toby Strout, had as a way to house former clients. And during that time, we were approached about buying that property from the former nonprofit. So I was involved from the beginning of that real estate transaction all the way through helping to raise the money, although I was not a fundraiser. I worked on grant writing, especially grants that related to the building and the different architectural aspects. And the hiring of an architect and the hiring of a contractor and that whole process to restore the Coca-Cola building and build a new building next to it and connect them in a way that worked for the program needs of Middleway House, which is a multifunctional complex now. It's their headquarters, it's their emergency shelter, childcare, and then permanent supportive housing.
Now, what was so special about this structure that made you and the Middleway House people say, this is a good place to be in?
Well, other than the beautiful two-tone green terrazzo floor.
That gets beaten up, doesn't it?
Well, it got beat up with the Coca-Cola. In the line where the Coke would spill over, that is where the terrazzo was most pitted out. You know that old put your tooth in a bottle of Coke when you, it's gone in 3 days?
Yikes.
Well, that's what it does to concrete as well.
Correct. So how long did that project take?
Oh, dear. Years. Mostly because of the difficulty in putting all the funding together.
When you walk around or drive around Bloomington, do you see any buildings that you say to yourself, I want to get my hands on that one?
Well, I used to do that all the time, but they're going fast.
Is that true?
They're going fast. I have a project right now that a friend and I have been kicking around a concept for, and we're looking around thinking, yeah, where are they?
Oh.
Ironically, you go to any town around Bloomington, and you have buildings galore.
Right.
You have supply, but you don't have the demand.
Right.
So here in Bloomington, almost every cool old building has been repurposed in some way. And a lot of them I've had a hand in, which makes me feel good that I've been able to make that contribution. But on the other hand, where am I going to turn now? I have to be really creative.
Cindy Brubaker.
Yes.
Thanks so much for joining us on Big Talk.
You're welcome.
You can hear that episode and all episodes of Big Talk with Michael Glab at WFHB.org.
Support for WFHB comes from Monster Digital Marketing, offering digital marketing solutions for small businesses. Monster Digital Marketing websites are built for search engine optimization with both the desktop and mobile device user in mind. Located at monsterdigitalmarketing.com or on the phone at 317-567-1197.
Support also comes from Growing Opportunities, a social business project of the South Central Community Action Program. Growing Opportunities is an urban hydroponic farm that provides job training opportunities for low-income people with barriers to employment, especially people with disabilities. They grow produce that is sold to local eateries, supermarkets, hospitals, and schools. Information available at 812-332-2168 or online at inscap.org.
Up next is our weekly public opinion segment, Voices in the Street.
Welcome to Voices in the Street, WFHB's weekly public opinion feature. Voices in the Street provides an opportunity for people in our community to share their opinions and perspectives on the issues and events that matter most to Bloomington residents.
This week on Voices in the Street, where do you get your news? There are many TV news channels to choose from. News broadcasts on the radio, social media news outlets on Facebook and YouTube, as well as more traditional newspapers and magazines. Given the multitude of sources for news to choose from, we have asked your neighbors and friends where they get their news.
Sadly, I find out about a lot of things through Facebook. That's my, like, go-to. But when I see something on there, especially politically, I really don't watch any news channels anymore just because of how biased they are. So I try to go to, for politics at least, factcheck.org is like my go-to place. As far as just general media, I don't know. I'm under a rock. But that's really the only thing I've been paying attention to lately.
I read a lot of the New York Times online, so it's probably most of it.
I listen to NPR, WFYI.
I guess the Weather Channel, Channel 13. I don't know. Internet, usually. My phone on my app. That's about it. The New York Times. Yeah, but that's because it's included in my phone, so, yeah.
I usually use Yahoo.
I use INES. I grab it off of campus. And then I'll check CNN and BBC every once in a while, but unfortunately I don't have something I read every day. So that's what I use.
Well, I read the Herald every morning, and I watch the national news at 6:30, and I watch the local news from Indianapolis at 7. That's where I get all my news, pretty much. Oh, and I also am on the internet, you know, Facebook, but I don't count that very newsworthy. So mostly it's that way.
My sources of news are usually social media. I follow CNN on Twitter, MSNBC on Twitter, mostly that, and some podcasts. But that's pretty much where I get my news.
Facebook, honestly, the most for me, which is sad, and NPR.
Yeah, I go to Real Clear Politics, Washington Post, New Yorker Atlantic, National Review.
Currently, I like to pay attention more to long-form journalism. I read Harper's, The Nation, New Yorker, New Republic. So primarily, again, I'm trying to stay out of the 24/7 news cycle. I find it more distracting than anything else.
Most of the news, I actually get them from more libraries or where libraries. Sometimes, I watch a few news and you get some few information, but part of the information that I consume, they are mainly from libraries. So I see like libraries the most important source of providing necessary information. Okay, thank you.
This has been Voices in the Street, WFHB's weekly public opinion segment, featuring candid commentary from your friends and neighbors on the issues and events that matter most to Bloomington residents. Voices in the Street is a volunteer-powered production of our News and Public Affairs Department here on WFHB 91.3 and 98.1 FM, community radio for South Central Indiana.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Kathy Norton and Joe Crawford, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, our partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Michael Glab.
Voices in the Street was produced by Barbara Provosky. Our engineers today are Chris Martin and Sean Albert. Our theme music is provided by The Impossible Shapes. Executive producer is Joe Crawford. For WFHB, this is Ryan Stacy.
And I'm Maria McKinley. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, independent daily news program.
If you use iTunes, you can have this show delivered directly to you. Just go to the iTunes store, search for WFHB Daily Local News, and subscribe to our podcast.
Now stay tuned for Blooming Out, Indiana's only LGBTQI public affairs show, coming up next on WFHB.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.
Comments, suggestions, and story ideas
may be submitted directly to our news staff via email.
The address is news@wfhb.org.